This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Daniel Pinkwater, is a prolific writer of children's books. His voice may be familiar to you from his commentaries on NPR's All Things Considered and Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. He also wrote and narrated a very funny satire of NPR called A Scroogiozzi Christmas, which was loosely based on the story A Christmas Carol and starred Kartok's Maliozzi brothers. Tom and Ray Maliozzi have described Pinkwater by saying, "Pinkwater is nuts." In People magazine, Pinkwater was described as one part Marx brother and one part cracked social satirist with a particle of werewolf thrown in. Pinkwater has a new book called Looking for Bobowitz, which, like many of his books, is illustrated by his wife, Jill Pinkwater. Here's how the book starts.
On Friday, I had my last day at Happy Valley Elementary School. On Saturday, the moving truck came and took all our stuff to Hoboken, New Jersey, and we left our house in Happy Valley forever. On Sunday, our first day in the new house, the temperature was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the beginning of the hottest heat wave ever recorded in Hoboken in the month of June for 120 years. 120 years ago is when our Hoboken house had been built. This is what my parents did. They gave up a modern house in Happy Valley, New Jersey, a house with a front yard, a backyard, and trees, on a street with similar houses and similar trees, to move to a brick house with no front yard, practically no backyard, and no trees, on a street with guys sitting on the steps drinking cans of beer and spitting on the sidewalk, and cars and buses running right past our door, and the Hoboken house was in rotten condition and cost three times as much as we got for our Happy Valley house. My parents said we were going to fix up the house and have an urban lifestyle. This is what an urban lifestyle is. My bike was stolen the first hour we were in town, and it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit. My mother said she didn't want me growing up in a suburb. She said life was real in cities. I went upstairs to sit in my crummy 120-year-old room.
Yes, a lot of us are familiar with that particular brand of urban lifestyle.
Yes.
But what are some of the cool things your character ends up finding in the city?
Well, first of all, he finds friends, which is actually what the book is about. He finds friends. It happens this kid, whose nickname is Nick, it has a collection of old, does anyone remember classics comics? Do you remember
them?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, sure.
Great things to learn to read with, you know, and it's basically, for those who don't know, regular comic books looking like comic books, they cost a dime, color comics, 52 pages, two staples, but the stories were Treasure Island and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, et cetera, et cetera. So he's got a stash of, they're out of print now, you can't get them. Maybe you can get him. He's got his father's old classics comics, and they're his pride and joy. And it turns out the two kids who live in the apartment house next door also are into classics comics, and that's the beginning of the friendship.
And he finds a pirate radio station also.
There's a pirate radio station in Hoboken, and it's a guy who plays old cowboy songs and blues and hillbilly music, all 78s. And he's operating from, here's where I mix historic fact and fiction, he's operating from the house in which Guglielmo Marconi lived, which really exists. He really lived there in Hoboken, the guy who invented radio. So the kids are into literature via the classics comics and learning about American music via the pirate radio station. And that's as much as I care to say about that.
Okay.
Read the book.
You've written over 100 books, right?
I read somewhere it was around 100. I never counted them.
Right, okay.
But that's a shame and a scandal, don't you think?
Well, let's trust the press here and say approximately 100 since 1970.
More than 10.
Would you describe yourself as a compulsive writer, or do you think it takes less time to write a children's book as it's shorter?
No, I'm more of a compulsive eater. but it doesn't necessarily take less time because it's shorter.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, I do them all. I do picture books, which my wife brilliantly illustrates, and I do middle grade books and novels like this one that we have here, and even more bigger novels. The picture books are harder, take longer, although a lot of the process can be sort of internal, and it's more of a trick to do a good picture book. You know, when you write a novel, I'll level with you. I was told that you can see through any kind of deception or dissembling, so I'll just tell you the truth. Writing novels is as easy as taking a breath, because people who read are habitual readers. Well, of course, kids aren't, which is why I like them as an audience, but adults who read are habitual readers. And so in general, the form for writing a novel is throw in everything, including the kitchen sink, twice. They'll thank you for the extra descriptions. So basically, when you write a novel, you just sort of drool on the page, and if you have an editor, they'll take some of it out. And it's really anybody can write a novel, and anybody does. Writing a good picture book is like, you know, a fencing match or a fast ballet turn or something or tightrope walking. You've got to get it right. You're working alone, and it's just got to be there. And if you mess it up, if you hit a sour note, it all collapses.
Well, you know what? If you want to believe what you just said about novels, I think you should go on believing it.
I continue to believe it.
Since you've been writing books since 1970, you must have met a lot of now adults who grew up reading your books.
Yes.
And what surprises you about what they remember or what really made an impression on them from your books?
What surprises me is how intelligent and interesting they all are. And also when they're younger, how quickly I bore them when they meet me in person. They ask me a couple of questions. I give unsatisfactory answers because I've written it. Okay, that took a certain amount of attention, but as you've already gathered, not complete. I've gone over it a couple of times in the process of getting it ready for press, and then it's done. They may have read the book 17 times and know every word, and so they'll say, on page 143, what does so-and-so have for lunch? And when I don't know, they look at each other like it's like either he's an imposter or an idiot savant. And then they'll try me with a couple of more, and then they'll just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, he's an adult. What do you want? And they wander off.
Does it make you feel bad, like you've disappointed your
audience? No, it makes
me
feel good that I helped them learn a great lesson, which is never meet writers you like.
Have you been burned that way yourself?
I'm not going to mention any names.
Okay.
Kurt Vonnegut.
Well, let's hope he's not listening right now.
Let's hope he is.
Now, you write commentaries for adults on All Things Considered, on
or whatever they are.
Weekend Show.
Yes.
But your books are largely or mostly for young readers.
Yes.
I guess it's good for you to have, a clearly adult voice as well.
I don't know that I care, and I don't know that I do. I mean, when I write for adults, the only thing that I have in mind is slow it down a little bit, dumb it down a little bit, because adults are people who, by and large, read as a means of getting off to sleep. And they're distracted, as they need to be, because they have all the adult concerns. A kid reading has recently or just learned to read, depending on what level we're talking about. The experience is still novel. It's very exciting. And in fact, they do read the book 17 times. If you are a novelist for adults and you get a letter saying, I read your book 17 times, you should be scared. You know, you're going to be stalked. but kids really do. They suck the ink off the pages. It's why I like to write for kids. And so when I write for adults, I confess, I may not bring the same attention to it because they're easier. When I was talking about how, you know, you can throw the kitchen sink into the novel, I really can't when I write a novel for younger readers because they won't stand for it.
Yeah.
There's no description in my books that runs more than a sentence because they'll skip it anyway and they're going to get impatient. They want action, they want characters, they want to know where the story's going. They want everything to really click and be tight.
Is childhood a place you'd like to return to? Like when you look back on childhood, was that a good time or a bad time?
It was good and bad. It's like life. You know, people ask me if I like children, and I say, you know, is that a case-by-case basis? What I do is I like to revisit my childhood. It seems to have a healing effect on me. And I like to write books that I would have loved to have at various ages. And my oversimplified way of describing this that I describe from time to time is you're 7 and then you're 8. The 7-year-old isn't gone. The 7-year-old is still there intact. The 8-year-old is there when you're 9 ad infinitum until you croak. So all of us carry within us our different aged selves. So it's not like I go back and write about my life, but I will start to get a clear sense of a moment. You know, it'll be tactile, it'll be sensory. You know, I'll smell things, I'll see dust motes in a sunbeam. It'll take me back to the back room in my parents' apartment in Chicago when I was, you know, 3 or something like that. And I'll get very in touch, and I get better and better at it through the years of going back to that kid who's still there, who was me. And then, you know, in some way, the book is created for that kid. And my theory being that there'll be other kids who have similar enough taste that they'll get it too.
Why do you think you get better at returning to memories from your childhood?
Practice. You know, it's like, I guess I haven't been psychoanalyzed because, one, I couldn't afford it, and other reasons too. But I imagine after a while.
You don't want to know, do you?
You sort of. I don't want anyone else to have anything to say about it. Uh-huh. I know plenty good because of my profession. I'm back there a lot, you know, and there's no end to the intercourse between your child self and your adult self. It never stops, and it motivates and conditions so many things we think and do as adults.
My guest is children's book author and NPR commentator Daniel Pinkwater. His new book is called Looking for Bobowitz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is children's book author and NPR commentator Daniel Pinkwater. His new novel for young people is called Looking for Bobowitz. When we left off, we were talking about his childhood. In speaking of your childhood, I was wondering, were you close with your parents?
Well, they were my parents. I was close to them. Close and frightened.
Frightened.
Listen, when you got a father that talks like this, doesn't matter what he's saying, and pointing with the finger, comes from Europe, you should be frightened.
Was he?
He was a gangster.
He was a gangster?
Well, he was a tough guy.
What did he do?
I don't know what he did. He wouldn't tell us, but I'll tell you this. In his office, in his dirty, messy office, he had a desk, and sometimes he'd let me come down. I'd sit while he made phone calls and hollered at people. I'd play with the things in his desk, which included 2 blackjacks. You know what is it, a blackjack, Terry?
Oh, yeah.
A sap? It's leather. It's plated leather. It's got a lead weight at one end, and it's sort of flexible. And there was a black one and a brown one. And I said, Daddy, what are these? Those is blackjack, sonny. I said, how come you got 2, one black and one brown? I said, the black one is with the gray suit, and the brown one is with the blue suit. So he did give me a sense of style, I feel.
Well, that's really funny. I guess you never met any of the people he used it on.
I met his friends and colleagues. He might have used the blackjacks on them as well. They were like that. His own brother used to hire a truck periodically at night and back it up to my father's store and take everything out and sell it.
Wow. Huh. So what did
they did that in the old country. It was a traditional occupation. I should say, there's great stories by Isaac Babel. Do you know those? Benya Crick, the gangster in Odessa?
I don't.
Wonderful, wonderful. One of the great stylists, one of the great short story writers of the 20th century was this guy, Isaac Babel. And he wrote, the collections are called Red Cavalry, I think. But he has a character called Benya Crick. And this is precisely how it was, because I heard the same stories from relatives. Insufficient employment in the ghetto, okay? Young Jewish men with nothing else to do would abstract things from delivery carts. Then they would write a formal business letter to the consignee saying, Reb so-and-so, by a series of circumstances not worth going into our hands has come a parcel belonging to you, we believe, which you may redeem at a set rate or expect a disappointment in your family life.
So,
and it was all done like that. And in fact, the name of the story is how it was done in Odessa. And I'm sitting in the funeral cortege, my father's funeral, and a wild cousin is telling me the same story in terms of my father's occupation on the other side.
So what did your father tell you about the business he was in?
Nothing. Now, he had a business, and in fact, he was scrupulously honest according to his lights. He was the kind of guy who'd come back a year later to give you the quarter that he owed you. And it's maybe because, and there's a story that upon arriving in this country, and I remember him saying to us, I asked him, what was your first impression of New York when you finally hit land? And he said, the size of the policeman. The average size of the New York City cop impressed him.
Was he mean to you?
He was not mean. He was cruel. There's a difference.
Fair enough. In what ways was he cruel to you?
He was basically just an old European father, so there was a lot of roaring and striking.
And did he think that that was good for you in the long run, or was he just sadistic?
He wasn't sadistic. He was more psychotic. We had a good relationship, I have to say. I enjoyed him. He enjoyed me. But he was nobody to mess with either.
Now, tell us something about your mother.
She was an awful person in her way, but she was pretty much quiet.
An awful person in her way.
Yeah.
What was so awful?
She's not worth talking about. She
really was awful.
I can't say I liked her at all.
Right. Was she mean to you?
She was mean in her way. She was. I would much rather have a bombastic, fisticuffs yelling father than. I don't want to talk about my mother. She was awful. I have a hard time writing sympathetic mothers, but I force myself.
Does that stand in the way?
Yes, yeah, sometimes it does. You know, I mean, you're in a position to get a couple of licks in, but then she's so pathetic that it's not that hard to forget about her.
Now, does that make it harder for you to make these kind of memory trips back to childhood at all?
No, the thing is, you know, it was a very chaotic childhood. My parents would disappear and go to nightclubs almost every night during the war. And they would always have a picture taken. And I would be awakened from sleep by my mother, smelling of cigarettes and wearing a mink coat, cigarettes and perfume, giving me a hug at 3 a.m. And they would bring me as a souvenir a photo taken in the restaurant of all these people, the men with broken noses, you know, and the women, you know, dripping with pearls and furs. And they were out, they were, I think, heavily influenced by Nick and Nora Charles. And there was all manner of strange things going on. There was a couple who lived in the back room of one of these long, enormous Chicago apartments that goes on forever. In the back room lived a Polish anthropologist and her husband, who was a political radical. And the Polish anthropologist was under contract to the War Department to research psychological warfare versus Japan. So to sort of get into the Japanese ethos, she was cooking a Polish person's idea of Japanese food. She did all the cooking. So I was raised on a bizarre kind of Japanese-Polish cuisine, all manner of stuff. And I had a much older brother and sister who my mother had thrown in an orphanage at one point before she married my father. They'd been pulled out. They were living there. They kind of raised me. It was quite an interesting setup. I had a terribly good time. The fact that my parents were not necessarily good parents, and in other circumstances, I would have been taken away from them probably, didn't really signify too much. My half brother and half sister, as my sister puts it, had learned human values in the orphanage, and they were raising me, and it was such an interesting world. It was such an interesting neighborhood. The kids in the backyards, Classics Comics, were playing games based on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Mysterious Island and so forth. I had a rich childhood, and I was discovering cultural treasures all the time.
Okay, rich and very unconventional. A lot of kids yearn to be conventional, and so if their parents are unusual or a sibling is unusual, it makes them uncomfortable. I guess you were okay with unconventional.
I didn't see it as unconventional, and also, I'm not sure it was. You know, when I started writing for children, I had a chance to write a book. I thought, I'll do this one, maybe I'll do another one, and then I'm done, because I will have addressed the concerns of all kids who have anything in common with me, meaning very smart, strange, unconventional, overeducated, whatever. And instead, I got all this mail from kids who identified strongly with my characters, and including their picture, you see somebody who's going to grow up to look like Van Johnson, who's the captain of the soccer team, and he relates. And I began to get it, that everybody feels isolated. Everybody feels that their parents are in some way not a good match. Everybody wants to explore and discover and find out who they are and what they like.
Daniel Pinkwater's new book is called Looking for Bobowitz. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Daniel Pinkwater. He's the author of many children's books. His new novel for young people is called Looking for Bobowitz. You probably know his voice from his commentaries on NPR's All Things Considered and Weekend Edition with Scott Simon.
Some of the characters in your book are fat.
Most of them are fat. Most of the good ones are fat.
And you've had a weight issue through your life.
I haven't had a weight issue. I've had weight.
Weight. And a couple of your books are about kids who are basically forced to go to fat camp.
Yes.
When you were a kid, what was some of the best and worst advice you got about being heavy?
The best advice I got, I only took about 6 months ago, and I got it from my father when I was like 8. He said, Sonia, if you want to lose weight, don't eat white bread, don't eat no potatoes, don't eat no spaghetti, don't eat no rice, don't eat no desserts, and you will lose weight. There's a guy who made a fortune with the South Beach diet, which works, by the way. I've lost about 50 pounds. And I'm, you know, my wife went on the diet, and I'm keeping her company. I lost about 50 pounds, and there's more to go, and it's going quite well, and I'm eating very well. And I said, wait a minute, my father told me this 50-some years ago.
That's really funny. So what made you decide to recently actually go on a diet?
I didn't. My wife went on a diet, so I'm eating what she eats. I'm not on a diet. I don't believe in diets.
Oh, it's like passive dieting.
I don't believe
I'm not dieting. She is.
That's right. That's right, and I'm sticking to that story. If I wanted to go out right now and eat a Black Forest cake, I could, and I would not be breaking any vow. I don't much feel like it. But if I did, I would.
Oh, okay. That's a good way of doing it. I guess that's working for you.
It's working for me.
Mm-hmm. So when you were young.
Yes.
And so what's the worst advice you got? That was the best advice. What was the worst advice?
The worst advice I ever got was, go to this doctor. He's the only one who can help you. Anytime you hear that, run away.
What did he do?
He gave me rice.
And only rice?
And only rice.
Was this some kind of special... Was it like the brown rice macrobiotic?
No, it was the white rice diet.
Oh, that's healthy.
I got sick.
Oh, that's real healthy. It's like the no-nutrient diet.
But he was the only one who could help me, you see. Well, anytime anyone says to you there's only one person who can help you, you're being had. If it's any good, everybody soon knows about it.
Now, I want to ask you a question about the name of a character in your new book, Looking for Bobowitz.
Yes.
And his name is Sean, and depending how you want to read the last name, it's either Ferguson or Fergesson. It's F-E-R-G-E-S-S-I-N.
Yes, he's a recurring character in other books.
Now, do you mean that as the Yiddish word forgotten or forgetting, Ferguson?
There's an earlier book, and this it pains me to say my first novel, Lizard Music, is the best book I ever wrote. Imagine my chagrin, 99 books later, still trying to match it. But that can happen, and it happened to me, and as you see, I'm taking it with good grace. And in it, there's a character named Shane Ferguson. And that, of course, is the classic joke, which is on the golf course or in the clubhouse, someone is paid, Shane Ferguson, this very Yiddish man, old man, goes to take the call. And when he comes back, his golfing partner says, your name is Shane Ferguson? We weren't introduced. He says, yes, that's my name is Shane Ferguson. And he said, this, you seem like an Eastern European Jewish person. He said, that's right, I am. So Shane, how do you? He said, well, when they asked me my name at Ellis Island, I was so confused. I said, Shane Ferguson, which means I have already forgotten. So this is an internal in-joke. There's all kinds of stuff, like raisins in the rice pudding in all my books, referring to things which are real, things which are not real but might be, and things which readers will recognize from other books. I can't help it. It's extra kicks. I just put them in. It doesn't hurt if you don't get them, but if you do get them, it just makes the rice pudding that much more enjoyable.
Well, that was like exactly the philosophy of the classic Warner Brothers cartoons. The Looney Tunes.
Yeah, sure.
There were all kinds of jokes that only an adult would get, but you didn't know that as a kid. You loved him as a kid.
When I was a little kid, I used to listen to the great comedians on the radio, you know, Bob Hope and Milton Berle and Red Skelton and Henry Morgan and so forth. And most of it went over my head, but that's fine. That didn't turn me off. You know, I really resent the idea that everything in a book should be age appropriate. I don't listen too much to the experts because they're boring. If the kid isn't getting it, he'll come back again, and I'll get a letter from somebody 10 years later saying, I was in an old store looking at old, you know, LPs, and it turns out that there really was somebody called Lord Buckley, like the guy you wrote about in your book. And I bought the record, and it's great.
My guest is children's book author and NPR commentator Daniel Pinkwater. His new book is called Looking for Bobowitz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Pinkwater, and you probably know him as a commentator on National Public Radio and the author of many books for children, the newest of which is called Looking for Bobowitz. Now, you said that your first book was your best book.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
What was it about?
Lizard Music is about a kid whose parents take off on a trip and leave him in the care of his older sister, who takes off on a trip of her own, which leaves him all by himself and free to begin exploring. And it's the first book in which the suburban kid is magnetically drawn into the old city to look around and find things. And he's on a particular quest because he's discovered that at night, after the TV station goes off the air, it comes back on the air, and there are lizards, actual lizards, playing jazz. And he wants to find out more about it, and that leads him into the city, and he meets various people, and he has quite an adventure, and it's just such a perfect book. I didn't know that I'd ever be allowed to write another one, and I just hit the notes perfectly.
What a great fantasy.
It's a great book. It's a great book. It's considered a classic. It'll probably live after I do, and it should. And all my other stuff, I'm getting better. I'm making progress. I have that to try and match. I don't think I've matched it yet. This one doesn't. Looking for Bobowitz.
You used to illustrate your books, so I assume you illustrated the first one.
I started out to be an artist. I went to New York to crack the art world. And it took years for me to realize that this wasn't a good idea. And I started as an illustrator. I started wanting to be an illustrator and wound up illustrating my own text because I didn't have a text to illustrate. Got more interested in writing. I went to art school. I have a degree. I don't like to draw. It makes me nervous. I like to write. It's completely pleasurable. Some people think that that's one of the many reasons why I shouldn't be taken seriously, because you're supposed to suffer. I don't. But I suffered plenty doing illustrations. My wife is the daughter of a painter, my wife Jill. And her mother is on the order of mine, and said to her two talented daughters, you may not be artists. One day she walked into my office, and I was sitting doing what I do, which is to say, staring off into the middle distance, and it's impossible to tell if I'm working or thinking or if I've died. So she, to see what was the case, she picked up a folder and said, what's this, you see? And I said, the story is supposed to be illustrated. And she said, how's about I do it? I said, fine, take a sketchbook, go illustrate, make drawings. And she came back in an hour with sketches, and they were just so wonderful that I called up the editor and said, look, this may seem off the wall to you, but instead of me illustrating the book, would you consider letting my wife try to? And she said, wonderful idea. Yes, we'll have Jill do it. We'll write up a different contract for her. Never having seen any of her work, It could only tell me how they felt about mine. and the fact is, she draws the way I would draw if I could really draw. I love her stuff. I just love it. And so I stopped illustrating because hers is so interesting and exciting, and it's such fun to see what she comes up with. She was writing some pretty good novels, but I'm not sure she'll be writing any more because I won't give her the time. I keep giving her projects of mine to do.
How long have you been married?
30-odd years or forever, whichever comes first.
That's a good track record.
Yes, especially since we got married 6 weeks after the day we met.
Wow.
And decided to get married 2 days after the day we met. And it's been clicking along ever since in its way.
Huh. Now, you don't have children.
No.
Too personal to ask whether that's intentional?
Who knows if it's intentional or ordained, but it works out that we don't have children, which gives us many kinds of freedom to do some things that we are able to do, not better than, but different than if you had children to worry about.
Did you want to be a father?
I have never felt a strong desire to be a father.
Some people might be surprised to hear that. Since you write for children, they might assume that, you know, it would be like your big goal in life to be a father.
No, it's my big goal in life to write for children.
Right. And do you think that you're not liking your mother and having your father be kind of cruel?
Well, obviously, sure.
That? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And my wife had a rough parent also, and that tends to make you think twice. Family life isn't as golden for us maybe as some people, although we appreciate it when we see it, but it's always like, gee, so it exists, huh? That's nice.
Not to compare, children with animals, but your family has a lot of, it sounds like, wonderful animals in it, cats, dogs, a horse maybe too?
We've had horses. They've all died off since. They're planted around this place, and I shouldn't say that. It's against the law to bury them on your property, but what are you going to do? The kindly old knacker lives in England. We have a real affinity and interest in dogs, and we've been professionals with dogs training. We wrote a wonderful book, which I can praise without reserve because my wife did all the thinking involved, called Super Puppy, which is in its billionth printing. It's been going on for practically as long as we have as a couple, and it is the best book there is about getting started with dogs. Don't be mistaken and get the pamphlet of the same name. We didn't write that. It's a book. It's a nice, thick book. And so we live with them. We interact with them. We study them. I have a strange Arctic sled dog who I taught to read off flashcards. She can read, but she won't heal. It's quite a story. She thinks she's a wolf, and for all intents and purposes, she is. And there are things she will not do because those are things that dogs do. But there isn't any rule against reading, so I taught her she can read her commands off of 3x5s. I caused the vet to almost faint.
So what do you love about having a lot of animals?
They're creatures of another species, and you can communicate with them. They see things in a way that's different than the way we see things. And seeing things through their eyes is charming and interesting and exciting.
Well, Daniel Pinkwater, it was really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was really great to talk with you.
Daniel Pinkwater's new novel for young people is called Looking for Bobowitz. Listening to music, especially classical music, is not necessarily a visual experience. But for classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, the visual part of the experience can still be important.
A recent scandal in the classical music world involved soprano Deborah Voigt, who was fired from London's Royal Opera because she was too big to fit into a skimpy costume. Voigt is an impressive singer. People want to hear her, not just look at her. But what performers look like is part of what they do. Voigt might be a more interesting artist if she were more interesting to look at. Not thinner, but more expressive, like Pavarotti, who is also not small, but you can read every flicker of feeling on his mobile face. Of course, some performers overdo it. I used to have a hard time with Leonard Bernstein because all his reeling, writhing, and fainting in coils distracted me from the music. Sometimes I wish I were home listening to recordings than at a live concert. Yet I still want to see a performance. With the great musicians of the past, artists whose recordings affect me deeply, but whom I was born too late to experience in person, I long to see how they play, to see them move. I love the great pianist Arthur Schnabel, but I've never seen an image of him in motion. The most profound and searching violinist I've ever heard is Joseph Sighetti. He appeared briefly in the 1944 film Hollywood Canteen, playing a short encore piece, then doing a comedy bit with fellow violinist Jack Benny. But where was any filmed record of Sighetti performing the kind of substantial music he's most admired for? Now, bless their hearts, Video Artists International has discovered 50-year-old kinescopes of Sighetti performing on Canadian television, and these have just been released on DVD. Here's Sighetti in 1954, with Wilfred Pelletier conducting the Orchestra of Radio Canada, in an 18th-century violin concerto by Giuseppe Tartini. Suddenly, the great dignity and inwardness I hear on Sighetti's recording of this, I can also see in his body language, in his expression of rapt concentration. The other pieces of music on the Sighetti DVD are the first movement of Beethoven's Violin Concerto, a Csárdás by the Hungarian violinist Jenő Hubé, one of Sighetti's teachers. And since Sighetti was a great champion of contemporary music, it's especially poignant to see him with pianist Arthur Balsam in 1960 playing Prokofiev's Second Violin Sonata, a piece Sighetti first performed in 1944 when it was still in manuscript. Work may be primitive, the picture quality may be grainy, and by 1960 the perfection of Sighetti's technique was beginning to be affected by chronic arthritis. But these films are a rare and moving image of a beloved figure, literally moving. Seeing films of this musician who's meant so much to me is almost like watching someone in my own family coming back to life.
Lord Swartz is classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new DVD, The Art of Joseph Sighetti.